Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Hayes Wuhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
the latest news is about 300 migrants rescued last night in the Mediterranean. As far as we know, they departed from Egypt. It was a very difficult rescue operation because of the bad weather and rough sea conditions.
That's reporter Antonella Siferazza in Palermo, Sicily, describing the latest rescue of migrants. Details coming up.
Also, the head of Libya's Tripoli-based ruling coalition has apparently reversed a decision to hand over power to a unity government. And Djibouti goes to the polls tomorrow.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the deal between the European Union and Turkey to reduce the flow of migrants and refugees is only weeks old and barely implemented. Nevertheless, it's already in trouble. AFP reports Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan has warned that Turkey will not adhere to the agreement if the EU does not fulfill its promises. Turkey has agreed to take back migrants who arrived in Greece after March 20th. In return, the EU has agreed to settle some refugees already in Europe, but it must also give Turkey money and allow passport-free travel. About 200 migrants and refugees were returned on Monday. Several hundred more may be returned tomorrow. Elsewhere, more migrants are again using the Mediterranean route to Europe, which can be a dangerous sea journey from North Africa. Today, the Italian Coast Guard rescued hundreds of migrants in the Strait of Sicily. They'll be brought to the mainland today. For more on that story, VOA's Joe DiCapua spoke with reporter Antonella Sferazza in Palermo.
The latest news is about 300 migrants rescued last night in the Mediterranean. As far as we know, they departed from Egypt. It was a very difficult rescue operation because of the bad weather and rough sea conditions. A few days ago, 1,500 migrants, including many women and children, have been picked up in about a dozen rescue operations at sea in only 2 days. So the number of migrants rescued in Italian Coast Guard and Navy operation is up sharply from the same period last year. Statistics for the first 3 months of this year showed more than 18,000 migrants have been rescued from smugglers' boats in distress in waters between Libya and Sicily.
So what happens after the Italian Coast Guard rescues these migrants? Where do they go?
Let me tell you first that in the past years, the largest group of migrants arriving in Italy were Syrians, while now this flow has significantly decreased since Syrians prefer the Greek route into Europe. So the majority of those arriving in Italy are people fleeing Nigeria, Gambia, and Senegal, and then Mali, Ivory Coast, Somalia, Eritrea, and Ethiopia. Once picked up, the migrants are ferried to hotspot processing centers. The hotspot processing centers are 6 in Italy, 5 in Sicily, but only 3 operating. And this is the new European approach system. The general idea is to create an area of disembarkation where migrants are screened, identified, and fingerprinted against their will if necessary. Those claiming asylum are immediately channeled into an asylum procedure and hosted in a reception center, while those who are not considered in need of protection are returned to the countries of origin. But the problem is that several human rights associations and the Italian Parliament Committee on Migration have been denouncing the estimate used to separate real asylum seekers from those who are just economic migrants. One of the main tools used in the Italian hotspot is the so-called foglio notizia, an information sheet. It is a very short questionnaire collecting some general personal details and, crucially, asking migrants what is the reason of their arrival. The questionnaire provides a number of tick boxes, and if for any reason you seek work among your option, you are automatically classified as an economic migrant, so an illegal migrant. The truth is that people do not fully understand the questionnaire. We know of many refugees who select work because they want to show their willingness to integrate economically, and for that reason they are denied the right of asylum. As a result, the Italian Parliament Committee on Migration said that this system is very discriminatory and it is increasing clandestinity, that is, migrants that stay in Italy, they don't go back in their country also because they don't have money to do it. They stay in Italy hiding their identity and living by their wits.
Let me ask you about the number of migrants and refugees Italy may expect this year. You had mentioned the route from Turkey to Greece, and as you know, the European Union and Turkey have reached a deal which now restricts the flow of Syrians from Turkey into Greece. Have you heard any Italian officials talking about an expectation that more Syrians will now try to make the Mediterranean route from North Africa to Italy?
Yes, with summer approaching and with the closing of the Balkan route, Syrians, together with people of other nationalities, will once again have to gain entry through Italy. European officials have predicted that Libya will become again the route of choice for both African and Middle East migrants, and expect some 500,000 to 800,000 migrants to arrive in Europe from Libya this year.
That was reporter Antonella Sferrazza from Palermo, Sicily. She spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua. The migrants rescued today in the Strait of Sicily include Syrians, Egyptians, Palestinians, Libyans, Eritreans, Somalis, Sudanese, and nationals from the Comoros Islands. Many migrants in Italy now find themselves stranded in the country because routes to other countries have been closed to them.
Saudi Arabian King Salman bin Abdulaziz has begun a five-day visit to Egypt. He's scheduled to meet with President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi and sign four funding deals worth more than $20 billion. The Egyptian president's office describes the Saudi king's visit as crowning the close brotherly ties between the two countries. The Saudi foreign minister calls the visit historic. Also, visiting Egypt today is Paul Ryan, Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives. Ryan is leading a U.S. delegation that met with President el-Sisi on a number of topics, including the fight against terrorism.
The head of Libya's Tripoli-based ruling coalition has apparently reversed a decision to hand over power to a unity government crafted by the UN envoy to Libya. According to an announcement posted on the website of Tripoli leader Khalifa Gweil, ministers of his National Salvation Government will be prosecuted if they cooperate with the Government of National Accord, or GNA. For a week now, Unity Prime Minister Fayez Sarraj and his GNA Presidential Council have been operating from a naval base on the Libyan coast. At the same time, the UN envoy Martin Kobler is negotiating with militia leaders and another rival government in Tobruk to support the Government of National Accord. The European Union recently imposed sanctions on three Libyan political leaders for opposing the Unity government. EU states also have considered deploying a civilian security mission to back the GNA.
Benin's new president promises to fight corruption and terrorism and foster economic development. Patrice Talon says he will use diplomacy to push for greater economic development. He also pledged to serve only 1 5-year term in office, an uncommon practice in recent African politics. Mr. Talon is a successful cotton merchant who easily defeated his opponent, former Prime Minister Lionel Zinsou, in a March 20th national election.
Djibouti goes to the polls tomorrow. President Ismail Omar Guelleh, in power since 1999, is widely expected to win another term. However, concerns have been raised about the country's human rights situation in the run-up to the poll. Mohamed Youssef reports from Nairobi.
Djibouti's president is seeking his fourth term in office. It is an about-face on the president's previous pledges to step down in 2016, but there's little suspense. President Guelleh faces six challenges, none of whom have emerged as clear front-runner. Some opposition parties are boycotting the poll, saying the Electoral Commission is not independent. The parties also complain of unfair media coverage and arrests of their supporters. Djibouti sits on the Red Sea. The United States, France and Japan have important military bases there. China announced in December that it will build a naval base. The bases are a key source of revenue for the tiny country. Regional political analyst Abdulwahab Sheikh Abdisamad says stability is paramount.
If there's any, you know, problems arise, Djibouti cannot afford political violence, which witnessed somewhere in, you know, elsewhere in Africa.
Authorities detained and expelled a team of BBC reporters last week. The Committee to Protect Journalists call it an act of censorship and say two local reporters had also been detained without charge in January. Results of the poll are expected as early as Friday night. Mohamed Youssef for VOA News, Nairobi.
Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni today ordered government security forces into the Rwenzori region near the border with the Democratic Republic of Congo. Unrest has been reported in the region since February's elections. 26 people have been killed, including five soldiers, in clashes between civilian and government forces. Mr. Museveni visited the area yesterday and said, "We can't entertain banditry and we can't negotiate with bandits." The area overwhelmingly voted for opposition candidate Chisa Besigye in the February 18th presidential election. The area has also been a haven for the Allied Democratic Forces, an Islamist rebel group with links to Al-Qaeda.
Well, new research shows that severe drought and floods triggered by El Nino weather events have put 100 million people in southern Africa, Asia, and Latin America at risk of food and water insecurity. The findings were released at the third Global Conference on Agriculture for Development, taking place in Johannesburg. The conference showcases new solutions to farming challenges, such as more resilient crops and soil, and investment priorities for young people who are key to the future of the agriculture industry. Dr. Kwezi Atakra is director of the CGIAR Research Program on Integrated Systems for the Humid Tropics in Ibadan, Nigeria. He is attending the conference and reports on the new research.
This is the dimension of business incubation, basically establishing a business incubation platform that enables us to tackle critical bottlenecks in agriculture. To give you an example, there is the area of particular problems such as aflatoxin, where the kind of commodities that we are growing, such as maize, groundnut, etc., are colonized by Aspergillus flavus, and that is very poisonous. A lot of people eat these major crops and they die. Now, through the research that we have done, we have produced what we call AflaSafe, which is a safe way of producing these commodities. And this AflaSafe mechanism, we've set up a mini incubation platform at the International Institute of Tropical Agriculture. The whole purpose is to show that private sector can take up an initiative like that and make money out of agriculture. Another example is a product called Nodumax, and this is a new legume inoculant product that has been developed at the IITA Business Incubation Platform. And this Nodumax makes it easy to encourage nodulation from legumes. So legumes are able to produce maximally. And once again, a business incubation platform has been established, and that provides a model for private sector engagement, you know, for them to know how they can also get business out of dealing with some of these wicked challenges that we have. It's a program called GoSeed. Now, GoSeed is aimed at empowering seed companies to improve farmers' access to quality seeds for higher yields and incomes. So it's really targeted at seed companies, and it really produces high variety seed. So basically, the seed supply mechanisms and how you deal with seed multiplication and ensuring seed quality are key elements.
Another big opportunity that you all are looking at here at the conference, I see, is getting young people more involved in agriculture and actually helping them to set up their own agribusinesses.
What we've been doing is to show how we can focus on high-value products and see agriculture as a business, and also to be able to introduce the concept of the value chain for the various components of agriculture. So they don't have to be agriculture graduates. They can be in ecology, in accounting, in various disciplines. We bring them from this mobilization effort. We take them through a mindset adjustment through training so they can get the particular technical areas of work. We also have to give them business development training that enables them to know how to manage their own ventures and the kind of organizational development processes. It is accompanied by mentorship and coaching, and eventually we link them up with the banks, including the African Development Bank, for instance, that have been helping to support the development of this youth agripreneur program. So the vision is built on skills development in agriculture and business development, and also the use of improved technology and value chain options, focusing on major commodities such as cassava, maize, soybean, banana, vegetables, etc., and also fish. You know, so these young men, they come in and they are excited, and they themselves train other young people. And it has been a very successful program thus far and repeated in a number of countries.
Dr. Kwezi Adekora is director of the CGIAR Research Program on Integrated Systems for the Humid Tropics in Ibadan, Nigeria. He spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa.
There was a sharp increase in the number of executions carried out worldwide in 2015, according to Amnesty International. At least 1,634 people were executed last year, a rise of more than 50% in 2015, the highest in 25 years. But the true figure is likely much higher, as Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
25 countries carried out the death penalty, but just three, Iran, Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, accounted for 90% of the total. In Pakistan, the December 2014 Taliban attack in Peshawar killed 141 people and led to the government ending its moratorium on executions. Chiara San Giorgio of Amnesty says use of the death penalty increased sharply.
Initially, the moratorium was meant to be lifted only for terrorist-related crimes, but very soon we saw persons being sent to the gallows for murder or other ordinary crimes, often, again, on the basis of trials that really leave a lot of doubts about the safety of the convictions.
At least 158 people were executed in Saudi Arabia, among them the Shiite cleric Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr, whose death heightened tensions between Sunnis and Shiites across the region. Riyadh says it uses the death penalty against terrorists, but Amnesty claims it is often used against political dissidents. In Iran, many executions were carried out for drug-related offences. Again, Chiara San Giorgio of Amnesty.
A significant non-proportion of the 977 executions that we recorded for Iran were carried out for drug-related offences, even if international law clearly says that the use of the death penalty should be restricted to intentional killing.
The true number of people executed globally is likely to be much higher because China is excluded from Amnesty's data.
This figure does not include the thousands of people that we believe were executed in China last year, where the use of the death penalty and the figures in particular in relation to the use of the death penalty remain classified as a state secret.
The United States was fifth on the list of the most executions carried out in 2015.
We recorded the lowest number of executions since 1991 and also the lowest number of the sentences imposed since the death penalty was reintroduced in the United States in 1977.
Only six U.S. states carried out executions last year, with Texas accounting for almost half the total. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The Earth is reportedly in the midst of its sixth mass extinction, a time when land and sea creatures are disappearing at rates up to 1,000 times faster than what it is considered the norm. As VOA's Roseanne Skirbel reports, the fossil record provides some clues to survival after the worst die-off in the planet's history.
252 million years ago, massive volcanic eruptions spewed billions of tons of carbon into the atmosphere, radically warming the climate and changing the chemistry of the ocean. Fully 95% of marine life and 70% of land creatures died. But to many scientists, it's the survivors that have stories to tell. One survivor that dominates the fossil records are therapsids, ancient relatives of mammals. Paleontologist Ken Angelczyk and colleagues at the Field Museum in Chicago did a microscopic analysis of a particular therapsid known as Lystrosaurus. Prior to the mass extinction, the animal lived a long life, 13 or 14 years. And based on the growth record preserved in its bones, Lystrosaurus was 2 meters long and about the size of a pygmy hippo.
When you go across the Permo-Triassic boundary, so you go through that extinction event and into the early Triassic period, the fall of the extinction, we find that most of our Lystrosaurus specimens are only 1 or 2 years old, and they seem to be growing rapidly throughout their sort of short lives.
As a survivor, Lystrosaurus bred much younger and spread to all areas of the globe to become the most abundant vertebrate after the fifth mass extinction. According to research published in Scientific Reports, rapid growth and a shorter lifespan increased its chances of survival by 40% in the unstable new environment. Angelczyk sees a modern version of this live fast, die young trend with the collapse of the Atlantic cod, which have been historically overfished, most recently in industrial scale operations. Early records show cod lived between 10 and 15 years, with the oldest producing the most offspring.
Most of the individuals that you find in a given cod population now tend to be quite young, and they're being forced to breed basically as early in their life history as they possibly can. And so we see kind of this pattern where you have lots of young individuals that are sort of struggling to reproduce as early as possible, given the sort of disturbance of fishing, kind of similar to what you see with our Lystrosauruses, where you have lots of young individuals that we think are being forced to reproduce as early as they can.
Yet what separates our times from those 252 million years ago is that the extinction crisis today can be blamed largely on human activities that promote a warmer climate, polluted environments, invasive species, and habitat loss. Angelczyk says ancient fossil records offer a reference for action.
The more we learn about mass extinctions, including the work that we're doing, it'll help us better understand what might be happening in the world around us today, better plan for changes going forward, and hopefully also help to prevent some extinctions going forward in the modern world.
Angelczyk says as we move deeper into the sixth mass extinction, Lystrosaurus provides a valuable primer for survival. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Swuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned for the sunny side of sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Skip Sisk, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Sports fans, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
Can't get enough of the Sunny Side of Sports? Well, we've solved that problem. We now have a half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC GMT. So visit voanews.com for more details and enjoy the show.
America.